nine men, and I think there were three women. I pay attention to that type of thing, flying over there. So I just wanted to comment on that, Chair Boquist. And then I still love giving my portraits of women combat veterans. This one is Sergeant Major Andrea Farmer, U.S. Army. We arrived in Kuwait, and it was really a bit scary because the war started about 2 weeks after we got there. We knew that the enemy was not far. We knew we were in a foreign country and that people were dying every day. And so we just didn't know if we were going to be next, if we were going to get hit by a rocket-propelled grenade or what. So all we could do is just drive on, continue to train our soldiers, and just do the best that we could and hope and pray that we would make it through each time. And then I'll just go to the end of her little portrait. A lot of us have chosen the military as a career, and we are serious about what we do and that we really care and that we have to obey orders despite how we personally may feel. I did get a lot of different opinions from civilians and even my family, but I think that they need to be more understanding of who we are and what our responsibilities are and our obligation to our country and our chain of command. I just try to explain to them our position and that it's not necessarily our opinion. We took an oath when we joined, and we're going to obey the orders of those appointed over us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
Colleagues and members of the public, a couple of changes on the agenda. The work session for SB 125 is going to be carried over as we're still waiting for paperwork. So the work session on 125 will be carried over to next week, and I'm certain at that time we will then have all of the paperwork. We're going to do public hearings on SB 133 and 461 very quickly, and then do the introduction of committee measures and then go back to the original agenda. So if you'll just bear with us a little bit, and with that, I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on SB 133. And General Caldwell and Deanna Mack, if you'll make your way down to the front while council gives us the background here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 133 was previously heard last week, that is on the 14th. As a reminder, it creates personal and corporate income tax credit for employment of veterans if certain conditions are met. It applies to the tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2013 and before January 1st, 2019 and takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment signed by.
Okay. One of you two may jump forward here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deanna Mack. I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 133. This bill is creating a non-refundable tax credit for employers, for anyone who employs a qualified veteran. And we just wanted to point out a couple of things that we think might make it a little easier to administer. First one is... And I talked with Nicole Hoft over at the Veterans Administration. She's in agreement this was not their intent. But right now there's no requirement that the veteran work in Oregon. So they could work anywhere in the country and have an employer with Oregon source income and offset that. And she didn't think that that was the intent there. So we're willing to work with her to get some language together to make that right. Also, there is no real certification process in here. It's not clear whether, based on some of the language at the back of the bill, how the department would know who's eligible to actually claim the credit. So we would like to see some sort of fleshing out of that process. And then lastly, the department, it tells on page 2, lines 26 and 27, it talks to the department would have to write rules to prescribe the length of time a veteran or an employer would have to keep their records. And we would prefer a direct tie to our statute that we have that's existing that says that they can to substantiate anything they claim on the return. So, and again, I'm happy to work with Veterans Affairs to make that happen. Any questions?
Sure. For the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, we would just remind the committee that they seen the issues that we've dealt with on returning veterans for the last several years of getting them employed. We've had great success from our Oregon employers, I would tell you that, but still, nonetheless, we're double-digit unemployment within the first 6 to 9 months as they get back. So anything we can do to entice employers to do more, even though they're doing a lot, we certainly have no arguments about some of the good stand-up things that have happened with many employers. This might incentivize other employers to get into this business a lot more than just the 50 or 60 that are doing it now. So we're highly recommend you you pass the bill. It fits DOR's needs and ODVA's needs as well, but we're looking forward to that. We think it'll help.
Thank you. And this has a subsequent referral to tax credits, and I sit on that committee, and I haven't seen it scheduled, so we have time is on our side for any decision that's out there. So unless the vice chair has a different opinion, I think we'll carry 133 over to next week. We'll ask DR and ODVA to get the amendments that are necessary so that the committee can then look at it as a whole as what it would look like in the future if it did pass out of this committee. Senator Courtney, any comments? Senator Olson?
No.
So with that, Madam Counsel, we're going to carry SB 133 over with the intention of reviewing amendments next week. And I'm going to close the public hearing and possible work session on SB 133 and open a public hearing and possible work session on SB 461. And 461, if Paul Mather will start making his way down here, and Counsel, if you'll give us some background here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 461 was previously heard on the 14th. It permits the portion of Interstate 84 to be designated the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Highway.
You're on.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT South. Senate Bill 461 designates I-84 from Portland to Idaho as the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Highway. It directs ODOT to install markers with this designation, allows ODOT to accept money from veterans groups to create and install and maintain these markers. ODOT cannot use public funds to install or maintain the markers. This is not a new process for us. We've followed a similar process with the designation of I-205 as the Veterans Memorial Highway and the designation of Highway US 97 as the World War II Veterans Historic Highway. Following a similar process, we would find the exact location, a number of signs, working with the veterans group that support this. For the assumptions that you'll see in our fiscal, we assumed 5 signs in each direction for a total of 10 signs, but again, we would negotiate that with the veterans groups. The exact locations, again, would have to be determined. Obviously, we would not want to conflict with other guide or warning signs that are out there, so again, we'd work with them to find the exact number and exact locations of the signs. ODOT would collect funds from the veterans groups to fabricate, install, and maintain these signs. Because of the work and the nature of the work on the interstate, we had some concerns about safety. We want to make sure that our crews were the ones to install the signs. They have the specialized training, specialized equipment to be next to a high-speed facility to install the signs correctly. On the interstate. If the signs did need to be replaced or damaged, we would seek that funding from the veterans group. So with that, any questions?
Senator Cordy, questions?
No. Senator Monasanders?
Senator Olson?
No. I do want to thank the department, because I did ask you to come forward and put it on the record to ensure that we did have that. So in discussions with the chairman of Business and Transportation, which we're going to ask it not be referred to, would be satisfied that this had its transportation cut on that. And we are in a...
We are in a possible work session, Madam Vice Chair.
Work session. Okay, yes. Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 461 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Business and Transportation be rescinded.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves SB 461 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Committee on Business and Transportation be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Senator Courtney?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Madam Vice Chair? If you call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Aye.
this to my consent next time, right? Yeah, okay. So I'm learning, right?
The motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. And with that, Senator Moniz Anderson, if you'd be kind enough to carry the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would like to commend our administrator for the exceptional letter she wrote to the other states. I hope it spurs them to follow suit.
Mm-hmm. Good reminder, because I don't have the note right here. Have all the members been able to review the letter that was drafted by council to go to the other states?
I have.
I see Senator Olson has.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if there are no additions or corrections, and if it's the consent of the committee, then we'll make that letter happen. Any opposition?
Could it go into OLIS also?
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, now that we've spoken about the letter, I wasn't sure it was appropriate for an exhibit, but since it's been referred to on the record, we'll exhibit
it. Could be as an exhibit. Great.
Okay. Any dissent? If there's no dissent, then, Madam Counsel, if you'll collect the appropriate signatures, then have it posted to OLIS, and we'll forward it from there. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on SB 461, and we're going to go up to possible introduction of committee measures. I will remind everybody that a vote in favor of any particular legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It's only indicative of the member's opinion. It's not indicative of the member's position. It's only a matter of introducing the measure for potential future consideration. Madam Counselor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the three LCs that the committee may introduce today are 2352, which is a placeholder on housing. It was a duplication of some work being done on the House side. We thought it would be prudent to go ahead and introduce it in case it became valuable later. LC 3292 is a placeholder on use of force issues, and LC 3644 is a placeholder on the county VSO services.
Are we in work session?
I'll open a work session for the purpose of considering LCs. I think we're already in one.
Okay, yes. Chair Boquist, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 2352, dated 11-28-2012. LC 3292, dated 2-02-18-2013. And LC 3644, dated 02-05-2013.
Vice Chair Moniz Anderson has introduced the legislative concepts as just recited to be introduced as committee bills. Any discussions? Senator Courtney?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Madam Vice Chair? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, so ordered. With that, I'm going to close the work session on committee measures, and we're going to move on to an informational meeting in terms of discussion of budget impacts at the military department, the National Guard, and the OEM. And with that, I will ask General Caldwell or whomever is the designated hitter to come down. And what we're going to do, members, is, again, this is a brief overview of the total budget, the policy impacts on potential state and federal reductions that are anticipated. If you didn't see, they didn't bother to tell the National Guard, but the Department of Army 2 days ago released a series of PowerPoint slides that show, I think, cutting 1,200 positions in the National Guard, so on and so forth. Of course, they were caught flat-footed. I suppose that's kind of like being interviewed by some of our newspapers. They didn't have any idea because they weren't even given copies of the slides. And then the same thing in terms of policy impacts of the OEM budgets and POMs. With that, General Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. And with me today is one of our key staff members in our comptroller's shop, which is Sean McCormick. So as we'll try to go through this, I know you're pressed on time, and we don't want to make it too quick, and many answers are not available to us at this point. We'll do the best job we can. And this is basically, first off, we're going to do a budget overview, pending state legislation, reintegration program, implications of the sequester, and then we'll have a brief topic with our Office of Emergency Management Director, Martin Plotner, who will talk about seismic and tsunami updates for the committee. And we don't have a...
We're working on it.
Okay. We have a really nice hard copy slide here in front of us that you would really enjoy if you could see it. But I'm sure it'll come up. Got to get warmed up.
Do you have a hard copy in front of you?
Is this what we're looking at?
Correct.
Yes, sir.
You got
that, that was a handout. There should be another presentation. Yes, sir.
Okay. Colleagues, this is what we're looking at, and we're going to go ahead and move forward while technology catches up.
As you'll see on the next slide, you'll see a bar graph. And on that bar graph, you will note that this is a depiction of our budget back to the 89-91 session. And you can see in that graph that things have changed dramatically, and we saw an uptick of general fund revenues back in 2001, 2005, 2003, 2005, 2007, 2007, 2009, and then from 9/11 down. Of course, we all know why that is. So that's no surprise. So I just point out a couple things. One, if you look at the where our general fund dollars are and where they're at today and where they were back, say, in 99-01, they were about even. And that's what we run. Most of those general fund dollars run facilities. They take care of employees and folks that fix things and the air bases as well. As you know, in Portland, air base is a 20% cost of maintaining the air base to the state. Klamath Falls is 15%, and the feds pick up the rest. The armories are 50-50. 50% state, 50% federal. And then the camps are varying degrees depending on what they do. So that's just a monetary depiction. The next slide basically shows you a comparative budget analysis from 2011-13 to 2013-14. There's some, again, some, you can see the difference in the 11-13, $28 million of general fund against 21 in the current one. Now, that's not exactly what it seems, because there was a $4 million push pass-through for the Vernonia. If you recall, the legislature made a decision to put $4 million to Vernonia, so that bumped this $28 million, obviously. That wasn't used by the department, strictly a pass-through. So that skews it a little. And also in the $21 million arena, the governor's budget has $3.7 million worth of seismic bond debt service that is shifted over to OBDD, which that hasn't been determined by the legislature, but that's in his budget. So that's why that number is not what it seems against the other number. But at least it shows you what the reality is.
And just for the record, that bill is coming to the committee, so we'll have you back on that topic, the
yes,
seismic
sir.
Shift.
OEM state budget, breaking it out, again, it's the increase in this governor's approved budget is slight. That is basically the increase that pays for the bonds that were purchased to build OEM, the facility at the Anderson Readiness Center. So that got ticked up to cover those costs, and that's the only increase. Everything else is flat or the same. There you go. The other numbers, again, are other fund is more of a guess than a science, as you well know. So we won't get into that. And federal funds, we're anticipating a drop in federal funds based on sequestration and other things. Next slide is 11-13, 13-15, governor's balanced budget. Just again, another comparison, approved budget, excuse me, from 11-13 to 13-15 against the governor's balanced budget. And I don't know what I'm trying to show you here.
This covers debt service, sir.
Debt service, okay. Yeah, read the slide, Mike. Debt service, and again, that 7.8 shows that movement out of the governor's budget of that seismic debt service. Critical approved packages, operations, new positions. These were approved in the budget, 11 FTE. You can see the majority of that is federal funded. Those are predominantly in the maintenance installations arena. Utility caretaker contract, you may or may not know that we have a contract with the Army who still owns the Umatilla Depot, and that contract provides 23 positions to operate it, maintain it in its current state until its final disposal.
Question there.
Yes, sir.
What's the latest on the disposal? I think we're done burning.
Yes, sir. We're done burning. The burning completed about a year ago, 9 months to a year ago, on schedule, on time. Right now, they're just finished the demolition of the majority of the burners. And I think I just saw a message last week or so, like 400 people are going to be laid off this month.
that are working on that project. So there's a few more things for them to do, but it's getting down to the end.
Is the 400 people contractors for the most part, or what are the 400 bodies?
They were employees of the contractor who was Westinghouse, but I'm not sure that they had the bid to tear it out. So okay. I couldn't tell you the contract, but it's a big company, multinational company, and they had to destroy the burner itself and then make sure it was clean enough that they could reuse the metal, bury it, whatever, depending on what they found.
Okay, Madam Vice Chair?
I have a question. That you're adding 11 new positions, new FTE, it says here, and in the times of cutting, when you said you're cutting...
Correct.
Is this just adding new positions because you're getting rid of some other positions? I'd like to know what this means.
Well, let me look for the detail.
I believe this is the existing budget, correct?
This is the governor's approved
budget from the present cycle, 11 to 13.
It's in the hopper now. It's
right,
at the legislature now as the governor's approved.
Right.
Facilities maintenance, we have, is that right?
You can get back to us on that.
Well, I should have that here, but I don't seem to find it here. Do you know which ones, where those are at?
Sir, they're for our general operations and facilities maintenance folks, or FMS, is throughout the state. The operations division can provide us some more details.
I'll get you details exactly where they are.
Yeah.
And you'll know what, but with that split, they have to be 75-25 employees, so they're probably going to fall in our field maintenance shop arena to take care of those maintenance activities. So we have shops around the state that do vehicle maintenance,
mm-hmm.
Artillery, weapons maintenance. The state's responsibility is to maintain the building essentially
right.
around.
Well, I understand that. I was just wondering why we needed more new positions.
Matter of fact,
that's what they.
Yeah, it's from 11 to 13. That's the existing budget here.
Yeah, we had 11.
This is what was
cut.
We approved last time.
We had them cut in the last budget.
Oh, I see.
So these are
asking for them back.
We're asking for them back because
gotcha.
The federal money became
okay.
available, and there was 75-25 money versus 50-50 money from the old 11. We actually cut 35 positions in the last budget. 11-13, we eliminated 35 positions. We had about 12 bodies in those 35 positions that we had to lay off in the last budget.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Kingsley Field Firefighters, these are all 100% federal funded positions. And 911 Sunset Extension, 9 positions. Again, that's because the 911 Sunset Extension and the Next Generation Coordination, since that bill is dying, then these have to be reentered as a new package in the budget parlance because they are no longer in the system because it sunsets out. So the legislature has to approve it new and then it plugs back in. Nothing, not going to change a thing. We're not adding any people. It's just got to go through the process. Other packages, these are the transfer that I spoke about earlier that would go to OBDD, the governor's recommendation, if the legislature approves it. And then we have the administrative savings, PERS taxation, policy, and other adjustments. That's how it sits. We all know that's not been approved by the legislature, but that's how the budget's built. Next slide. These are packages that we sought, did not get. You can read them for yourself, but the bottom line is that there isn't, the governor didn't feel he had the general fund to supply or to take care of that. So they were denied in our package. One of interest, probably the two most critical ones in my mind are the OEM IT consolidation. We were trying to consolidate all of our IT into one place at the Anderson Readiness Center. We have one state employee who does, for the military department, I don't know how many machines he runs, I think, 7,500?
It's well over 100.
Well over 100 desktops he has to handle, and we got one guy. So we were trying to consolidate that, move it over to the Anderson Readiness Center, put it all in one place, and then get some synergy from some folks that are bill paid by 911 and federal grants and that sort of thing. Not that we would cheat the system, but it would work better. That was denied as well. Next slide is
this is the handout
that we gave you that Right, has all the legislation that you all are very familiar with, so I didn't want to walk through every piece of that because it's all of the Senate bills and House bills that you're dealing with. Okay. And you can see that separate. I know you already know it, so. Next slide. Family Assistance Program. Family Assistance Program provides 10 federally funded family assistance specialists, and they're located throughout the state. We have a section called the J-9, which takes care of reintegration. And you can see on the slide the six essential services that we provide and some of the accomplishments that we have done over the last year with this group of folks. It's been very effective and very necessary. We're not, as you'll see later in the presentation, we know that there is this is a high priority of the Department of Defense to keep these resources out here for deployments and redeployments, and we don't know exactly what the numbers are going to look like now, but it is in the top of the priorities. It's listed in their priorities. Next slide is JTAP, or the Joint Transition Assistance Program, back to the earlier bill, 133. This is these are the folks that actually got, we have on staff, 12 federally funded JTAP members, and they're located again throughout Oregon to work with our soldiers to get them employed. And they do other things as well. Education, push guys to education with their GI benefits, or if they need health coverage, we get them tied up with the VA. And you can see the numbers down there. I think the thing that we're most proud of is that we believe that this is money very well invested, because we can calculate if we can get a person a job or get them into school using their GI benefits, it's going to save taxpayers a ton of money. We estimate $8.9 million. So it's a pretty good return on the investment of the federal expenditure. Our next one is the concerns. We're again not certain what it's going to look like when the sequestration hits. This is what we know now. There's going to be a reduction, but we think it could be larger. We just don't know. And if we don't have the federal funding, we of course cut those positions, because there's no state dollars in those positions. As you know, we've got we have a deployment coming up in 14, and we also know that we, of course, had a deployment today that several of you were at, and those folks will be coming home as well, and so we'll need to deal with that. So those are our concerns. And the next one talks about the national impacts on sequestration. We know there's going to be personnel impacts, equipment impacts, training, facilities, operations, et cetera. In your packet, we provided you a study that was just recently done for the Congress from George Mason University, and the economic impacts of the Budget Control Act of 2011 on DOD and non-DOD agencies. And provided that for your easy reading when you're nothing else to look at. I would highly recommend you kind of take a look at the first two pages, if nothing else, because it kind of details some of the fear and angst that these professional educators have come up with, what they could have. And I think the most significant thing to me was that many predict that this action will cause a second recession, which I think would be absolutely terrible for everybody in this country. But we'll see. Next slide. We've got a slide that shows this. Actually, Mr. Chairman, you and I were talking about this. I got this out of the USA Today. About an hour or two later, it came in from DOD. So it was nice of them to let the USA Today have a jump on this. But and I saw the headline literally get in the coffee shop, and I saw that headline, and I thought, when I got to work, I got online to see what they had, and then literally an hour later, it pops up. Oh, yeah, we probably got to see these slides we put out, So you can see in this slide that it estimates that there will be, a $26 million reduction in the state of Oregon with 1,547 jobs. This, again, is the Army's estimate. This is what they're putting out right now. I think if you bore down, some of their numbers look a little fuzzy to me, but then again, who knows at this point. Next slide.
But before you go on, but the point is that...
It's close.
Somebody in Washington, D.C. did this, actually across the river in the Pentagon, right? Didn't bother to talk to you about it, right?
We had not seen them, yes, sir. We had not seen the slides, literally in at least an hour or so after this thing, after I got to work, which would be noon back at in D.C., and I'm sure that they cogitated all morning when they realized USA Today had published it and decided to share it with us.
So we really don't know what jobs they're talking about at this point. It's a We have no details.
The details lacking significantly, but this really talks about, you know, the end strength. So I'm assuming that what they're talking about are jobs that are related to the Army National Guard, but I suspect also it's got the Corps of Engineers, you know, rolled up in this, the United States Army Reserve rolled up into this, and so I think, and that might be pretty close, those number of jobs, because as we move on through here, we're going to see some slides that talk about 22 furlough days, you know, 12.5-13% reduction. So if you do that math, that's a pretty close number, and I don't know what the Corps has or the USAR has, but we're figuring that's not a bad number.
Okay, thank you.
Again, the this is nationally, Army National Guard operations and maintenance cut $662 million. Army Guard military construction basically $622 million. Air Guard targeted for O&M for $709 million, and Air Guard MILCON 31.8. And then, of course, as you know, under continuing resolution, you're already about you're 10% below where you were last time, and now you're trying to make it stretch, and now this hits. Go ahead. National impacts. You know, we believe this will be the result of these in the military, but certainly will affect us. Our qualification, job skills, et cetera, will diminish. Advanced training will be curtailed. We've already been told that. We struggle now with medical and dental for mobilization because we don't have, you know, the best medical care and dental care for traditional guardsmen, unless they choose to have insurance from their employer or take TRICARE, which most of them don't. So we think that's going to hurt our medical readiness. And then again, here's the place where the high number of technicians would be laid off. These are temporary technicians, and we have several of those in the state of Oregon. And the hiring freeze for all military technicians. So any job that comes open, we won't have. Again, I talked about 22 days of furloughs for military technicians. That's the plan right now until the end of the year. So that's literally one day a week, which is a 22% salary cut that we'll have to get all of our military technicians. And we have roughly, we have that number. I think it's around, yeah, there it is. We got 1,197 of those. And
total
DOD is 3,561. So you take all those positions and you curtail them one day a week. That's a tremendous loss of manpower, et cetera. We're very concerned about that, and we're looking at how do we manage those furloughs. We know how to do it on the state side because we've been doing it a while. Federal side of our house hasn't had to do this, so we sat down with some folks and said, you've got to make sure we maintain 5 days a week so we can get the payroll made and we can do the other things that people depend on us for. So it's going to be a challenge.
So a question. So what you're really saying is this, because of other considerations, instead of like the state, which is a furlough day and the whole state is closed down for the most part, you're going to still have to maintain 5 days a week, and it'll be partial.
That's correct.
Furloughs across the board.
Yes, sir. And it'll be one day a week. And we do this now on the state side of the house for the military department because, you know, we view ourselves as being available and ready, and people depend on us not being closed. Mm-hmm. And so we do that currently. Ours are floating furlough days. We don't take those ones that are okay. Designated on the calendar. We just take them when we can. Okay, next slide. Again, there's some of the other impacts. Equipment reset. Certainly, you lose technician manpower that do all the maintenance. You're going to have problems with our equipment being maintained properly. Air Guard. Certainly, they're. We have a real-world mission, as you well know, here in Portland, but we have a training mission down in Klamath Falls, and we suspect that they're going to be curtailed dramatically on flying hours. Right now, they're talking, the word is a ground A-10, C-130s, F-15s, F-16s, KC-135s, and HH-60s. That's in the Air Guard that they have control over, and we see the same thing coming in the Army Guard. So, you know, it's just what you would expect in this kind of a circumstance. Next slide. Sustainment, again, we're going to have trouble maintaining. We already have a $72 million backlog in the Oregon National Guard for legitimate maintenance needs, and this will just continue to exasperate that without the federal money. We already have trouble meeting the federal money now because we haven't had the money from the state side to meet the federal money, so we've left some of it on the table or looked at 100% federally funded projects at certain bases in certain locations. It's not a very efficient way, but that's what we've done. Next slide. On operations, we have our concerns. We believe that the acting component units will probably stay in rotation longer. The cycles will get longer, which is going to put a strain on them as well. And the dwell time on the guard is going to be greater. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, when that happens, you're not relevant, and they'll look for other ways to cut the force structure, which cuts money, which cuts assets, and the ability to respond to emergencies here at home. So we're concerned about that. And having been down these roads a couple times, as you have as well, you know, that's how they think. National priorities, as you can see, that the national priorities in the Bureau is Homeland Response for Forces, which we have here, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear forces of Bernie, and enhanced force response packages. Yes, sir.
Question, the newspaper, the Oregonian of the Statesman carried an article about potentially the Air Guard NBC unit going away.
I know, so that was actually the unexploded ordnance unit.
Right, EOD.
EOD. And that's 4-6 guys, something like that, and all that equipment. And that is scheduled to leave on the Air Force's budget. It's really separate from the sequestration, which will put a bind on local governments that don't have the ability to do that kind of work. And state police, they can do it, but it will shift some of that burden. But if it's a military munition, local governments and state police, local law enforcement folks don't mess with it. They call us at the airbase, and our guys go out and take care of it, which is the way it should be. But now you're going to wait till they come out of Fort Lewis or McCord. Next slide. Training readiness. We're going to cut flying hours. We're going to park aircraft. Regress readiness standards for pilots and maintainers, which is very, very unnerving to us. And deferral of facility restoration modernization projects, which we knew that was going to come. As we said earlier, that termination of 83 military technicians in the Air Force. Right now, those are temp positions, 22 MilTech furlough days, which would save another $7 million in the Air Guard. In the Army Guard, we're going to do the same, reduced O&M, no new construction, removal of units from deployed cycles. If they do that, there'll be irreversible impacts. And the degradation of the Army aviation capability, loss of full-time staff for maintenance and training will impact us and will impact our ability to do rescue missions. Next slide. These are the priorities that the Adjutant General has laid out for the Oregon National Guard. Mission to 142nd Fighter Wing, as you all know, has a real-world 24/7 mission and 365 days to do air sovereignty alert over the Pacific Northwest. The 173rd is the single only Air Force training site for F-15 pilots in the Air Force. And then the next priority would be these Oregon Combat Group operations. So those are our three priorities, how we list them in the Air National Guard is how we want them to go. And the lowest being the 116th Air Control Squadron. So if we're going to cut folks, it's going to be in the bottom to support that 142nd mission. Next one is the Army impacts, which again, here's another slide out of USA Today. Got this right off the computer yesterday. We're not sure exactly where they came up with these numbers, but you can see what we see and what's in the public. Camp Riley, a $1.1 million reduction. The Oregon National Guard reduction, 14.19, and the USAR at 0.54. And then they put an impact on FLIR, who's a major supplier, as you know, for the military, which they'll stop all those contracts. The ones they can stop, they will stop. Go ahead. The impacts, again, on the Army side of the house is reduction in qualifications. It's going to be a hit. 22% of annual medical dental exams. That'll be a big hit as well. And 22 MilTech technician days or furlough days. And 80 temporary employees that we have. And we live, unfortunately, in the federal side, we sort of live off temporary technicians. What the National Guard Bureau does and how they man the states is they say, here's a manning document that says you can have all these positions. This is what you need to do your job and the kind of units you have. But we're only going to fund you, Adjutant General, about 50% to 60%. And how you want to fill those positions, you can do however you choose. So if there is extra money or we can move money from another account, then we hire the temps. And that's really what we live on, are the temps. We've got an authorization to hire probably another 125, 30 people, but we don't have the money. So that's how we play the game. We live off temp techs. And unfortunately, they're going to be going away under this slice, and it's going to really hurt us. And then we'll have a hiring freeze as well. Next slide. Economic impacts, standard fuel parts. And I might point out also, for example, we have a program up at Camp Withicum that repairs generators. All those employees are state employees. The federal government pays us to repair broke generators, put them back into the system, and redeploy them. We've been very successful. It's at high marks. We've got 66 employees in this, all state employees. That is a program that we could immediately reduce to zero and move that money to these other operations. But it will have an impact that you won't see on a federal slide, because that's how it falls on the state side as far as accounting goes. And we hope we don't have to do that, but that's an outside the tent contract that not directly related to what we have to do here in the state of Oregon. We'll suspend all the flying activities, C-23, C-12, at our Lakota, which is basically the new helicopter that we received to do primarily drug interdiction and work with the Oregon State Police and local law enforcement officials. I'll just get down to the bottom. 30% reduction in base operating services as compared to the FY12. That's a big hit, 30%, as you know. And we'll lose our flight school. There won't be any flight schools for folks to send them to, because that takes additional dollars. Next slide. And our contingencies, our mission to be prioritized, search and rescue, wildland fire, 102 civil support team, and then our SERP, which is the also for local law enforcement backup, and then our National Guard Response Force, natural disaster response, and then aviation. And that's how we would do it. We'd start at the bottom and work our way up, supporting those first three missions we believe are the most important. Next slide. And you can see the numbers. 12% to this agreement would cost us, 12% cut between now and the end of the year would be $5 million, and 22%, which we think it could go that high if they try to make it all up in this last two quarters, then it would be a $9 million. And I mentioned RSMS program 66, position funded with the general fund and federal funds. And you can read the slide. It's cut, go. U Challenge, it's been a very successful program. You're very much aware of that, I know. Right now, we've been told that they would cut from 75% to 70% federal share. Going back to D.C. next week for a new challenge meeting, and I'll probably learn more when I'm back there, unless I hope to, because I think that's this is one of the programs that typically that's the first place they go to look at this program. We're right in the middle of our fall class or our spring class, graduation in June. We'll do everything we can to keep that going. Again, those are 48, 49 state employees that operate this with this money. 25% of that money comes from the state of Oregon to run the program. All but $200,000 of that program is ADM and the federal money. The legislature put in $200,000 to make that work, which we'll get on that later. Okay, go on. Emergency Management Performance Grant. And I think I'll invite my Director of Emergency Management to come up here and talk a little bit about this part of the equation.
Before, let me ask a couple of unemployment questions.
Yes, sir.
So we know the impact at our level. You made mention there are 66 state positions that are obviously underfunded, which are the maintenance positions.
Correct.
I understand that. Because they're in their state positions, do they pay unemployment insurance and they're in the pool, or are they out of the pool and then we have to fund the unemployment liability?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the way it works is that formerly the federal government allowed us to take money every year out of the agreement, out of their federal money, and put it in an account. They changed their rules. They said you cannot do that any longer. So if and when you have a state employee in this federal program, they will pay 75% of the cost of that unemployment in a 75-25 program. Where RSMS, for example, maintenance repair facility up at Withicum, that's 100% federal program. Mm-hmm. So they would pay 100%. So we would then say, calculate the unemployment cost, working with the state, with the employment department, and then we would bill that program and say, okay, you can cut it off, or they would probably tell us, say, fine, this is all the money you're going to get this year, so you got to shut it down at a certain date. At the end of the day, they are liable for that. It's not going to come out of state money, except for in this program, 25% would.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Paul?
General, on a previous slide, you talked about the fact that you're going to do a bottom-up approach. You're going to eliminate the bottom folks and come up. And if the 234th engineer company is set for mobilization in the third quarter, would you just not send them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, well, we would try to have them what we call move to the right to stretch that out further. We have some real question marks whether or not, based on the President's announcement 2 weeks ago, with the 34,000 soldiers coming out of Afghanistan within the year. We don't know what that means, but we think this was based on those soldiers being there. So we're thinking, we're guessing at this point, that that mission requirement is going to shrink. We don't know that, but we're guessing. So right now, as we look at prioritized missions, that's on the bottom because they're the furthest one out before we'd have to deploy them.
Hello? If you did have to send them, would they be sent not prepared, not trained, and ill-equipped?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, no, that would not be the case. What it really tells us, typically when we see a unit on here like this unit we just mobilized today, prior to that happening, roughly a year out, 9 months to a year out, you see additional resources come to you. You see additional authorizations to hire people. You see additional resources to go hire dentists and all these things to get all this work done to make sure that they're deployable. And we also get more training dollars. So in their case, they had more dollars to go out and fly their helicopters and their fixed wings, so they're more proficient. So we're not sure what will happen here, but at 9 months out or so, we'll know, because then they'll start throwing the money. We will not move that money. We will not move anything. We'll keep them on the regular cycle that they're on, just like we do every other guard unit right now in the state. What probably we are going to see happening is where we have demands and needs to get people to, like, rifle ranges that require buses or other outside contracting. That's how we would prioritize these folks, is that we would start at the top and work our way down to get the money first. Now, keep in mind, we've got 50 more, 60 more units out here. They may suffer. They may not get the bus, but they would go to this priority here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Impacts on the Department of Homeland Security sequestration. This is, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, I'm Marty Plattner. I'm Director of the Office of Emergency Management. When it comes to the emergency EMPG grants, the Emergency Management Performance Grants, the State Homeland Security Grants, and the Urban Area Security Grants, EMPG funds the local emergency managers in the 36 counties across the state in either a part-time basis or a full-time basis. There are 16 state positions funded with that. The implications right now is it may delay the release of the next series of EMPG grants. That's what we're hearing at the federal level. Or they may skip a cycle, is some of the other conversations that they've been having. In the area of Homeland Security grants...
Let's follow up here. What does skip a cycle mean?
EMPG grants don't really run on an annual basis. They run on about a 15-month cycle. And what they've been discussing since the last one ended in September of last year is they may not introduce the next one until January of next year. So that would be January of 14, so it would skip 3 to 5 months, which means a lot of those counties would have to lay off all those emergency managers at the county level.
Right, that's the point I was driving at right there.
In the area of the state Homeland Security grants, this funding grant actually has been getting chipped away at over the last 3 to 5 years. It's almost at about 50% of what it was in 2009. It continues to be more regulated and less funds availability with it, but we do have 11 positions in my office that are actually funded 100% on that grant series alone. The UASI, which is the Urban Area Security Initiatives Grant, we use that actually as a pass-through through our office. There are no positions funded, and there's no funds held at the state for that, but it does affect the five urban area counties and a lot of the localized employees that are funding projects in the five-county radius for that grant.
Next slide. This is, a subject near and dear to this committee's heart, seismic and tsunami updates, and I will let, again, Director Plotner give you the latest, greatest on what's going on in OSPAC and also the seismic rehabilitation grants.
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I provided some information on some key events coming up over the next couple months. In March, I provided a schedule of the outreach going along the Oregon coast for the tsunami, the executive summary for the OSPAC study that's going to be released on the 28th of February to, I believe, the House, as well as some talking points with that. And I've provided the summary of the seismic grants. Gives a one-pager on just a rollover of those grants, and on the back side of that, you'll find a breakdown of all the awardees and the status of those bonds.
And its current state. And with that, we'd certainly entertain any questions that you may have based on that quick overview, or not so quick.
Let me just ask, I guess, first the military department and then OEM second, to generally categorize the future, 10% cuts, 15% cuts, 20% cuts at the federal level, because I know OEM lives and breathes on the federal funds, and so does the military department. What do we, if you summarize all this together, how bad is it going to get?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think whether you're talking OEM or you're talking the Air or the Army National Guard, we're 97.5% federally funded in the total scheme of things.
Right.
So when you take a 10, 12, 13, we've heard as high as 22% cuts from federal money, it's going to have a serious, serious impact on our organization. There's no question about it. You can't get around it. Office of Emergency Management has roughly, as you saw on the earlier slide, about $2.1 million of general funds. That particular, I'd say everyone but maybe one or two positions is at least 50-50, if not 75-25, federal funded. So when you roll those all in together, you know, in order to save, if you lose the federal money, what are you going to match? I mean, we don't have the state money to match it, or even to supplement it or backfill it. I think we all know that. So yeah, I think it could be disastrous, frankly. And we're having a meeting after this meeting with your legislative fiscal office, because they want to look at the 5, 10, 15% cut package we put in, and it's even uglier than what we just talked about. Because once you get past about 2.5-3% in our budget, it's all bone. There's no meat, no blubber left. It's all bone. So yeah, it just gets pretty ugly.
And there's really no, for better word, guidance or indication from the federalists what they're doing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've gotten some guidance. It's been rather hazy at best. There's a meeting this weekend. General Reese is getting on the, on the plane tomorrow morning to go back to D.C. because they're bringing all the adjutant generals in, and they're going to lay a bunch of this out. We're hoping at the end of that process that he'll come back, and we'll see the digits, and they'll say, here's what we're going to do. This is what's going to happen. Because I think they were a little slow to pull the trigger, frankly, DOD was. I didn't think they didn't think it happened. I mean, they parked the Truman Carrier Group, for God's sakes, and said, we're not sending it to sea, and it was scheduled for deployment. The Navy did. So, I mean, that's significant when you park a carrier group. So, kind of sounds like Ways and Means today, doesn't it? It's not a pretty picture. But we're confident that whatever they give us to do, we'll figure out how to adjust to it, and we'll make it happen. Or there'll be things we just quit doing, too. And I think that's the reality that we all have to do, understand, whether it be the repair program we're doing up there, or whether it be youth challenge, which would hurt me greatly personally, and of course as our institution, and I think helped a lot of kids. But if that's what it is, that's what it is. You know, there's just
having had the honor of sitting behind a dais one time during tough budget times as a county commissioner, I can tell you, these are not fun times. I know what you're going through, so my hat's off to you.
Yeah, it's not tough times, but the unfortunate situation is we know that at least on the Department of Defense side, that they could do this a lot better. And the National Guard and the Army Reserve and the Naval Reserve are a lot more bang for the buck. And we're paying the consequences of bad leadership in Washington, D.C. You don't need to comment. Of course, you're civilians. You can comment.
It's 30 cents on the dollar. The Guard and Reserve are 30 cents on the dollar for against an active duty person. So if you want to save 70 cents on the dollar, you just go to the Guard and Reserve and you eliminate the active duty forces. To a certain extent, you can do that, and I don't think you'd see any degradation. I firmly believe you'd never see any degradation in the nation's ability to conduct war and defend itself. There's a certain line that we all know you can't cross, that you have to have those guys who can go every night, within a minute or two. We're not good at that. You know that. The reserve components are not good at that. They have to be active duty. But beyond that, well, I guess you were one of those groups in the reserve component, one of the very small amount of people that you served in had to do that overnight stuff. But the majority of it, that's probably 0.1% of the total reserve component.
Of course, General, our colleagues at the federal level will take months before they make a decision, so there'd be plenty of time to mobilize the Guard. So.
No. They'll never do anything quick in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
Thank you very much. With that, we're going to move on to a public hearing on SB 32, which are legal changes to the Oregon Code of Military Justice, and I'll open that public hearing. Madam Counselor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 32 establishes the Oregon Code of Military Justice governing state militia, and it's my understanding from the materials provided during the summary or the interim, this bill marks the completion of a transition that began in 2005, organizing state laws governing the military into a comprehensive body of regulatory code that's better aligned with the Uniform Code of Military Justice at the federal level.
Went high tech.
Well, Captain, you're out front. You might as well just leave there. You know?
Yeah, I plan to leave you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. I want to give you a quick overview, then I'm going to turn it over to my right is Captain Tony Garcia, who is a Judge Advocate General in our Judge Advocate General Corps, and he is the legal expert on many of the things that I'm sure that you would want to come up with. Oh, you even copied that for me. See, I left the office so quick today because, you indulge me for a second. General Reese is supposed to be and he was, at this ceremony. He called at about 11:15 and said, I am stuck in traffic on I-5 because he had a doctor's appointment up north this morning. And he says, you're going to have to go do this ceremony. So I'm grabbing things. They're handing me stuff. And I'm running out of the office. And I printed this off, but I didn't pick it off the printer. So I went high-tech and got my iPad out, and there it was. So at any rate, but thank you, Captain. Senate Bill 32 is a housekeeping measure. In many regards, it's a housekeeping measure to conclude legislation passed in 2007, which authorized the governor to approve the Oregon Code of Military Justice promulgated as a regulation by the Oregon Military Department. Oregon National Guard sought regulatory-based Code of Military Justice in order to afford flexibility of the Oregon Code to keep pace with changes promulgated by Congress for active military and eliminate need to seek legislative changes with each federal change. Original legislation anticipated subsequent elimination of statutory-based punitive articles once regulation was promulgated. The key points, eliminates punitive status, which are now established in punitive articles in the Oregon Code of Military Justice, clarifies jurisdictional supremacy at Section 4 between civilian courts and military commanders, clarifies statutory language to reference Oregon Code of Military Justice, vice former references to ORS Chapter 398 provisions, eliminates statutory statute of limitations and defers to Oregon Code of Military Justice statute of limitations for military prosecutions, which is drawn from the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And with that will be the prelude, and with that I'm going to turn it over to my learned young JAG officer with a degree from the great University of Oregon, correct, Tony?
Yes, sir. For the record, I'm Captain Tony Garcia with the Oregon National Guard. Ladies and gentlemen, as you can see from the enclosed bill here, what we have is four different sort of ideas that we're trying to convey here. It's mostly a housekeeping measure, but what we want to do is remove some of the statutes, because this was initially statute-based, And we have come up with the Oregon Code of Military Justice that we now use and update. And what we have is a lot of amendments made to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is used on the federal side. And that is updated annually. And so what we've done here is we make our updates to the Oregon Code of Military Justice. So when we enacted this previously, it was always the vision that we would remove some of these statutes. So that's what we've done here today. There's not a lot of changes in here. The only substantive changes in here that we have are a couple relating to the statute of limitations, which are narrower. And if you want more information, I could provide context on that. And I think that's all we have, subject to your questions.
So what we're really doing is updating the state active duty side. That's what we're talking about. In the case of people who are mobilized for fires, God forbid a real disaster or something like that. So that's really what we're doing, is updating the Oregon version that's used during a state duty status or a call up by the governor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, not necessarily. Anybody under the command of the governor in Title 32 status would fall under this statute, would fall under the Oregon Code of Military Justice. Certainly in a state active duty status, it's no question, but it is Title 32 as well as state active duty.
So the provisions are essentially similar, but it's just different rules, and depending on whether the soldier is in Title 10 status or Title 32, depends on which reference we cite. But they're essentially exactly the same. So if a soldier is being charged with theft or forgery or something, they're charged with the same crime, just it would have a different designation, whether it's under the Oregon Code of Military Justice or under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's a federal and state distinction. Generally, our soldiers who are serving on IDT status, which is on the 1 week in a month type status that most soldiers serve on, they would be prosecuted under the Oregon Code of Military Justice.
I might just make one other distinction. It's really been General Reese's policy that, and I think it's still the case in our JAG section, if it's a local issue, even though it may be in an armory during a drill, we'll typically go to local authorities and allow them to prosecute if we think that's justifiable in this instance. But it also allows us, if they choose not to, and say, which happens occasionally, say, no, it happened on your Camp Rylea during your training thing, you guys handle it. We don't want to mess with it. So we work back and forth. We don't try to preempt local jurisdictions.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I have no knowledge of how this happens except when I watch TV, if you have someone committing an offense and you prosecute, where is that done? It's not done in a courthouse, is it? Where do you?
Ma'am, we have various avenues under which we do the prosecutions. So we have anything that goes from an Article 15 non-judicial punishment on up to court martials. And even within court martials, we have various ones within that. So we have not done a court martial in Oregon, a full general court martial, in a number of years. What we tend to stick to is some of the Article 15 hearings. But those would take place, an Article 15 hearing can take place just about anywhere, usually in a commander's office or a drill hall or a conference room. And then the court martials, which are usually done on the active duty side, usually do take place in a military courtroom.
Thank you.
For a generalization, just for committee education, an Article 15 is probably closest to an administrative court judge. That's
correct.
Sort of the type of structure
traffic
you're
thing.
Trying to, not the same, but if you're doing parallels.
I, Mr. Chairman, I would probably characterize it, we all know justice courts, justice of the peace, that would probably be closer to an Article 15 comparison, where it's low level, it's a traffic fine, it's something that's probably most generally there because of behavior issues. They don't show up for drill, or they show up in not the right uniform, or and allows the commander to what they term non-judicial punishment. So it's instead of going on your criminal record, you got a ticket for 50 miles an hour and a 35. It's a good way to look at it.
Other questions, or is it all Greek to you? Okay, if there are no other questions, what we'll probably do is carry it forward so anybody that does want to put input. I don't see that it's such a riveting topic. I don't see that anybody has signed up to talk about this.
other than the two gentlemen that are obviously here right now. And then we'll carry this forward to next week. And again, this is pretty much a housekeeping upkeep that we not routinely do. I think we actually did one in 2005. We did a few edits to the Oregon Code. And I think in those, really the applications back then had to do with more of when we were doing firefighting and state active duty, making sure everybody was locked into it. I do remember being a guard commander and being the one who did issue the warrant, and the sheriff did go out and arrest him and put him in the county pokey for a Friday night, and interestingly enough, AWOLs dropped right quickly when we did that.
It only takes one.
Just one other little comment on this. Because I brought forward that sexual assault piece of legislation, to sending it to the military. I mean, if there's sexual assault here, is it quite different how you handle that here? Or maybe you haven't had a case like that. Is that an Article 15?
No.
No. So.
No, generally not, ma'am. An Article 15, a soldier can be prosecuted in those two avenues and have an Article 15 and a court-martial for the same offense. Generally, something like a sexual assault, essentially let me back up a bit. In the Uniform Manual for Court-Martial, it designates that anything that is punishable by a civilian equivalent of a felony or higher should be prosecuted in a court-martial and is not appropriate for an Article 15 procedure. So something like a sexual assault, of course, is a felonious act and would be handled through a court-martial. I don't know if you want me to get more in-depth about how we handle
it. If we chose to prosecute it, I would tell you that there's been a couple of incidents that have occurred in my 25, 28-year full-time tenure. I've been in the institution for 41 now. The only one, and we had some incidents years ago that were pretty felonious, and we immediately referred it over to the district attorney.
Okay.
Many years ago, we had a situation that occurred, and the law has been changed since then. The legislature changed it, where we had an act at Fort Lewis where a young man was killed, and it was an accident, but it was not very good leadership, and some mistakes were made, and there was the federal government said, "Well, you're Title 32, working for the governor, you're on federal ground. We're not going to touch it." Big Army said, "We don't want to deal with it." State of Washington said, "Well, it's on federal ground. You're from Oregon. We're not touching it." There was quite a hue and cry from some of the survivors that wanted some action. We were unable, because of our statutes at the time, to do anything about it. We would have done something if they refused. We have since changed that statute. So if that was to occur again, and both the federal government and the local district attorney in that situation choose not to prosecute, then we would have probably put that into a court-martial. In today's law, we can. We couldn't then. So we fixed that in order to have that next bite as an example of how this cascades down. And they chose not to go after it, so we would still have that option if we chose to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? Mr. Courtney?
No, I do not.
Sir Olden? With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 32. We'll schedule a work session for this next week. If there's any members of the public that don't want to be court-martialed or don't want to fall under this code, they should probably forthwith, whatever, let the committee know so we can bring that into the record next week. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 33. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 33 adds 13 agencies to and removes one from the list of those required to designate a person with authority to allocate resources to act as liaison with the Office of Emergency Management for emergency response.
And why are we here, gentlemen?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of Oregon Military Department. I'm going to turn to my learned Director of the Office of Emergency Management to explain this, but I think it's pretty much housekeeping. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Marty Plattner, Director of the Office of Emergency Management. Senate Bill 33 is basically designed to expand the level of agencies that support the Office of Emergency Management in a time of crisis. The It also makes sure that those agencies that do participate in that state of emergency have the authority to dedicate resources as part of their tenure during that emergency. So it's a clarification and a housekeeping and more of a wide range to allow our agency and other state agencies to participate and support at the state level in the event of an emergency.
So in English, we're making sure that the departments know when the 9-0 happens that they have to send somebody, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct, sir.
Mr. Chair, I would just add, these folks already participated in our ETC. They do it all the time, but we didn't have them in the law. Right. So it's, you're here, you're doing it, they're very good at it, and they've committed to it. So it's not an issue of putting a gun to anybody's head. They're already doing it, codifying what we already do.
Having been there, I know that's true, and Senator Courtney's been there and seen their empty seats that are there because it was an emergency, so I know that's true. But really, I know that's true for a very simple reason. There's no one else signed up, and if it wasn't true, every one of these agencies would be back here with a fiscal jumping up and down that they can't do this. Madam Vice Chair?
Well, it seems like, thank you, Mr. Chair, I was trying to match up what you cut out and then what we added in it. And you cut the Oregon Military Department, but I don't see the Oregon Military Department.
They are the Oregon Military Department.
I know you are, but it's not listed.
And Council says she has clarification here.
Oh, good.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, I can summarize quickly that the additions are in conformity with current practice. Department of Consumer and Business Services,
right.
Department of Corrections, Department
yep.
of Justice, Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Judicial Department, the Department of Aviation, Public Utilities Commission, Department of Fish and Wildlife, State Fire Marshal, State Forestry Department, State Marine Board, State Parks and Rec, and the Water Resources Department, and because it's a de facto the governing our housing entity for OEM, OMD is the one entity being removed.
Correct. It says the Office of Emergency Management, which is in statute under the Oregon Military Department.
Okay.
So.
I just thought maybe you needed it. Okay.
I can't come to your own party.
Yeah. So as an infantry officer, so if you don't have the keys to the door, they can't come anyway, right?
That's correct.
Okay,
yes.
Got it. Committee members, comments? If there's no comments or nobody other riveting testimony wants to come forward, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 33, and we will post a work session for this technical bill next week. And I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 97. And I do see we have a new face. Sean McCormick is going to come up and join.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. With me on my left, of course, is Director Marty Plotner, and on my right is Sean McCormick from our Comptroller's Office. And I'm going to let them explain the disaster response account.
Thanks, sir. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm a Budget and Policy Analyst with the Oregon Military Department. And I thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm here today to discuss the impacts of Senate Bill 97 on the Office of Emergency Management. We're going to cover some legislative history, the proposed changes made by Senate Bill 97, the impacts of OEM staff resulting from the current statutory requirements, and a discussion of potential kicker implications. In the aftermath of the December 2007 winter storm, the 2008 legislature passed House Bill 3626, which is now Oregon Revised Statute 401.532 and 401.534, which created the Oregon Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund and the Oregon Disaster Response Fund. That legislation also designated these funds as separate and distinct from the general fund. The intended outcome from creating these two funds was to ensure that the legislature could distinguish the difference between expenditures associated with mitigation efforts and those associated with disaster response. The military department has brought forth legislation to modify these two funds during the 2010 interim session, the 2011 regular session, and now the 2013 regular session. The bill for the 2011 session was House Bill 2074, and it was heard and passed out of the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection. proposed changes outlined in this slide are the same recommendations that the military department has been trying to have adopted since the 2010 interim session. We'd like to see the title of the pre-disaster mitigation fund changed to the emergency preparedness account to accommodate a request from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. FEMA has stated in writing that the majority of the federal grants within this fund are classified as preparedness funds, which are not associated with disaster mitigation efforts. The legislation also changes the title of the Disaster Response Fund to the Oregon Disaster Response Account, and changes the title of the Oregon Local Disaster Assistance Loan and Grant Account to the Oregon Local Disaster Assistance Loan and Grant Subaccount. It's quite a mouthful for an account title. We would also like to see all of the accounts established within the general fund. The primary issue affecting OEM staff is the current statutory language, which designates the two funds as separate and distinct from the general fund. Due to this clause, OEM can no longer utilize a tool known as linking allotment, which is a cash flow tool. Linking allows the agency to temporarily borrow a general fund, which has already been appropriated to the agency in its biennial budget bill, to pay bills before federal funds are received. Once federal funds are received, the general fund is automatically reimbursed. Current language also requires that OEM utilize multiple clearing accounts within the state financial management system. Utilizing these accounts has resulted in additional reconciliation processes, an increased risk of transaction errors, and a more complex audit trail. But most critically, it has resulted in inefficiencies and a serious increase in workload for the fiscal staff. This slide shows the number of additional entries into the state financial management system that OEM has had to make so far this biennium to accommodate statutory requirements. The red line indicates the total number of staff hours it has taken to complete these transactions. The combined total of entries equals 12,796 and has taken an estimated 942 staff hours with an associated cost of $27,450, which has been charged directly to the federal government. If Senate Bill 97 is passed, these additional transactions go away, allowing the fiscal staff to redirect their efforts towards grant management and providing faster service to the local governments that ultimately receive these funds. And that's the primary mission of these positions. The primary reason this issue has not been corrected in the past is there is some uncertainty regarding the potential implications to the general fund state kicker. To clarify this point, we need to discuss and understand the differences between the quote-unquote legal general fund and the appropriated general fund. The legal general fund is the Treasury Fund 0401, which is comprised of monies from a variety of sources. The monies in this fund can be broken into two different categories. The first category consists of monies derived from sources that are not otherwise defined or directed towards a specific purpose. And the best example of this is personal and corporate income taxes. These funds are considered to be available for general governmental purposes. To our knowledge, these funds comprise the general fund appropriations for biennial budget purposes and are often referred to as the appropriated general fund. Basically, those are the funds that the Ways and Means process utilizes to break out across agencies. These are also the funds that are forecast for the kicker as required by ORS 291-348 and ORS 291.349. The second category consists of monies with a statutorily specified purpose. These are monies which reside in Treasury Fund 0401, but are otherwise unavailable for general governmental purposes. This distinction, to the best of our understanding, excludes these funds from being utilized in the forecast for the kicker. Senate Bill 97 moves the existing funds or accounts, as they're going to be called, into the legal general fund, but does not alter the purpose of the funds. The monies in the accounts identified are continuously appropriated to the military department for dedicated and specific purposes. Due to the dedicated nature of these funds, they are unavailable for general governmental purposes, meaning the legislature cannot direct them to whatever need they would like. And this distinction, to the best of our understanding, excludes them from being utilized in the forecast for the state kicker.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is that, since obviously this committee has not developed, you know, gotten involved with the kicker and the ramifications from that, it's been the revenue committee. And so I feel that as at a loss as to me sanctioning something when we haven't really been in the process of that at all. So it'd be nice to get input from revenue and legislative fiscal, and not necessarily the committees, but at least from the offices here that work for us.
I would agree with you, Madam Chair.
Chair Boquist, Senator Mons Anderson, we have been working with the Chief Financial Office. Art Ayers is available in the room today. We have made contact with Legislative Fiscal on this topic, and they're discussing it internally. And I believe Art Ayers has contacted Paul Warner in the Legislative Revenue Office, and we've also discussed it with the Office of Economic Analysis.
Thank you.
So on. I got a couple questions, but I'll wait to the end.
Much of what I've shared with you today regarding the general fund came from discussions with the Treasurer's Office. They share in our belief that the modifications made in Senate Bill 97 do not alter the purpose of the funds to make them available for general governmental purposes. The Military Department has also discussed this topic at length with Art Ayers, the Chief Financial Office, and at this time, he also believes that the modifications made in Senate Bill 97 with regards to the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund and the Oregon Disaster Response Fund would have no implications to the state kicker, but he'll be able to come up and make comments on his own. So, in conclusion, our request made in Senate Bill 97 is for both the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund and the Oregon Disaster Response Fund to be placed within the general fund. This will allow us to streamline our accounting processes and do away with the clearing accounts and the corresponding duplication of efforts. Additionally, we have requested to change the name of the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund to the Emergency Preparedness Account in order to accommodate the request from FEMA. At this point, we are confident that there will be no impact to the appropriated general fund or the kicker calculation as a result of Senate Bill 97. We also want to assure this body that our ability to identify and distinguish between mitigation expenses, preparedness expenses, and disaster response expenses, which was the primary goal of the 2008 House Bill 3626, will not be impacted in any way by the change to the title of the funds. This concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just so I understand, since I set up revenue too, and unfortunately do understand the kicker, what are the dollar amounts? So obviously, this is significant enough that
it's raised flags.
So this is basically a cash flow account. I got that one. But right. What dollar amount are we talking about that it flags such a deal?
Chair Boquist, the total amounts for our pre-disaster mitigation fund, we have 18 preparedness grants that total $42.5 million. We have five pre-disaster mitigation grants totaling $20 million, and those would reside in the pre-disaster mitigation fund, mm-hmm. the one we're asking to be changed to the emergency preparedness fund. And then within the Oregon Disaster Response Fund, currently, I'm aware of five active disaster grants that have a total value of $91 million and five active post-disaster grants totaling $17 million. These are all 100% federally funded grants, and they should not be classified as available for general governmental purposes.
Because it makes the account look like there's $172 million in kicker money in it. That's the issue right there.
That's correct. Correct. And I think Art may be able to provide a little bit more clarification on some of the...
Yeah, come on down here, because we're going to have LRO and LFO both get us some information. And if it's not ironclad clear, this could be going to another committee.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Ayers. I'm with the Chief Financial Office, and the Oregon Military Department is one of the agencies that I oversee in that office. And Sean has been working with me over a period of time to try to clarify this issue of whether or not these changes in Senate Bill 97 would impact the kicker calculation. And I've had direct conversations with staff in the Office of Economic Analysis because they are the people who actually do the calculation of the kicker. And my conversation with Michael Kennedy in that office indicated to me that their formula for calculating the kicker draws only on general governmental revenue that is in Appropriation Fund 8800, which, as I understand it, none of these revenues would touch or would be classified as. So my understanding from his description and his understanding from my description of what this would do is that there would be no impact on kicker calculation.
Thank you, Council. Could you get Paul Warner involved in this, please, and have him look at this and double check with the state economist so that we're all on the same sheet of music and where we're going, and then once you have that, if you'd be kind enough to get it to me so that I can have a discussion with the Chair of Revenue to make sure we're not stepping on somebody's toes here.
Yes,
and
sir.
Then from there, I will raise the issue with the presiding officer at the appropriate time.
if I could figure out what it is we're doing. I grasp what you're doing, but I also understand the complications of the kicker impact and why. I was thinking a couple hundred thousand dollars. You were saying 28,000, but 172 million would make the front page of the Oregonian, I'm quite sure. So, and I would ask if you could follow up with the department so that we can get Palmer involved and then double check with LFO to make sure that they're on board with what we're doing. And then I will meet with Chair Burdick once we have that information, and then we'll get back to the committee of what the next step is. Vice Chair?
Yes, I agree totally with that.
Yeah, I was thinking a few hundred thousand dollars, but not of that number. No, thanks. I'll pass that. Chair Courtney?
Yes, Chair.
Questions?
Many.
But not here, right? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, gentlemen. With that, if there's no further questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 97. It will not be scheduled for a future until we get some clarification. With that, I'm closing the public hearing on SB 97. Madam Vice Chair, other issues? Senator Courtney?
No, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson?
No, sir.
With that, I would just remind the public of any of the bills or issues that came up. Please be in contact with committee staff if you'd like something entered into the record before a work session is held. I believe for just clarity that we're going to be revisiting SB 125 next week along with SB 32 and 33, but not 97. And with that, meeting's adjourned.